I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Planet Premier League podcast. Each week, Cesc Fabregas, Nader Manua and myself talk all things Premier League.
As a player, you don't have time to talk.
No.
You don't have time to make a plan. You just need to deal with wave after wave after wave.
We watched Coach Carter and he said, oh, afterwards, the game's just about doing this for your teammates. And I remember looking around halfway through the film and half the squad was asleep.
Planet Premier League. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Hey, everybody, this is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Media Podcast. My producer is Patrick Antonetti. Today's guest is a regular one. He's back, John Orand of the Sports Business Daily and Sports Business Journal. It's been, might be a couple months, actually, at this point, since John was last on this podcast. But this will be your conversation about the sports media. Haven't had one of these in a while. I've had a lot of guests. And John Orand, America's sports media podcast guest, is gracious enough to return to the Sports Media Podcast. John, welcome back.
Don't have a lot of time, Richard. Let's get right to it, man.
All right, I know you've got Trina awaits, or whoever else you've booked this week. All right, we have a lot to discuss, John, including some of the stories that you've broken in the last 24 hours. But here's where I want to start. The NFL and the NFLPA are in the midst of their collective bargaining. And one of the big topics, of course, in this has been the addition of a 17th game for the NFL. You've also, John, heard about what looks like it's going to happen. And correct me if I'm wrong, maybe it's already passed, is the more playoff teams being placed into the NFL postseason. What I want to discuss with you is what this means for television and the media rights holders, because it's really, really fascinating. If you add a 17th game, that is significant more inventory. And then if you add two more teams to the postseason, well, you know, when you kind of cut the postseason up, you might be able to get some more inventory there. So very open-ended, John. When you see these two very significant things for the National Football League, what do you think about when it comes to media rights?
Money. I mean, the main reason why the NFL wants to add a 17th game is because, you know, they're going to get paid for that 17th game. And the main reason they're going to what did ESPN pay for the wild card game? I think it was like $100 million for like one NFL wild card game.
Just a crazy number.
An insane number. And so all of a sudden they're going to add two more wild card games. Like all of a sudden, like, you know, they're going to get a pretty penny for those. There's one aspect of a 17th game, and the players haven't actually said okay to it, but all my sources expect that to happen. So they think the owners are going to be able to give up something in order to get the 17th game. But I think the really intriguing part to me has nothing to do with the NFL. I mean, if they do get a 17th game and they add to the playoffs, all of a sudden, you know, Super Bowl weekend is going to start falling where NASCAR going to do with the Daytona 500? Are they going to sort of be pregame programming for the Super Bowl, or are they going to try to, you know, do it on a different day, maybe on the Saturday, maybe push it a week? Same question with the NBA All-Star game. I mean, it's a big showcase for the NBA. I mean, are they going to have to go, you know, a week early, a week later? I just think there are all these sort of knock-on effects with other sports that are and other sporting events that are really popular that I just think that the 17th game is really going to affect.
That's interesting. All right, so a couple things there, just my take. One, I mean, unquestionably, they'll move off the Super Bowl. And Fox is a partner with the NFL, so they'll and ESPN is a partner. Well, actually, although Turner has the All-Star game. But I think they'll figure that out. And I would still think, just my guess would be that easier to move the NBA. You could always push it, I guess, a little bit back. The Daytona one you do want to hold on a Sunday. So that's a little bit more of an interesting one. But here, let's sort of stick on.
But how about Sunday leading into the Super Bowl? But then you have to worry about the rain and everything.
First of all, I don't think Fox ever does that if they have the Super Bowl. The question would be a really interesting one is, would you dare counter program against a competing network having the Super Bowl? But my answer to that, John, would be no, because the NFL would tell Fox, hey, we are a rights holder partner with you. Do not put the Daytona 500 against, let's say, NBC's doing the Super Bowl, because we don't want less viewers. So I can't see it. I mean, the NFL has the leverage there against the rights holders.
Well, I mean, they would be going against Super Bowl pregame, not the Super Bowl. But yeah, the point still goes.
I still say no way. I think the NFL protects the. I think the NFL would protect its rights holder partner. Let Fox know in very strenuous terms they don't want that on the same day. You don't think so?
No, I would agree with you, but I do think that there are, Fox is a NASCAR rights holder too. The NFL is certainly more powerful than NASCAR, but I just think these are discussions that are going to be really interesting discussions to see where it all nets out.
I agree with you. But, I mean, at the end of the day, John, we're talking about one property that draws 9 million, 10 million viewers. Versus your other property, which on a week-to-week basis draws 20 plus, and in the 415, 425 slot, 25 million. So I think the NFL would have the power there. And listen, I like the Daytona 500 as a sports fan. I don't want that on the same day. I want that to be on a different day because I don't like that that competition. Let me ask you, so a couple things here. Let me ask you about the postseason stuff. Do you think if they get, I think it's very clear they're getting an additional postseason games. I mean, that's going to happen, the two additional teams. Do you think there is any chance the NFL would bring in a new rights holder partner, let's say, just for that game? So let's just sort of play a little hypothetical football here. Like if Turner came in and said, we don't want a package for the year. We just want to buy that postseason game, and here's whatever, crazy money, $300 million. Think the NFL would think about that, or do you think that only goes to a partner that shows games during the year?
Look, the NFL has been very clear about its strategy moving forward, that it's a broadcast-centric strategy. And I can't imagine them doing a playoff game that's not on one of the broadcast networks, and they're in cahoots. They're in partnership, I guess I should say, with all of the broadcast networks. So I think, like, Amazon or Turner or Tennis Channel, who knows? Sinclair could try to bid on them. I think it's Confederate money, pretty much.
Yeah, and that's interesting because I tend to agree with you. And if that's the case, then I think ABC is getting another playoff game.
Oh, yeah, that would be my bet. I would absolutely bet on that.
Now, I don't know if they get both, but I think they're getting a second one for sure. Now, the quality of that game, will be really, really interesting. I mean, it could be 2-8-8 teams or something like that.
It could be, but last year it could have been Pittsburgh against the Chiefs, in the AFC, and that would have been a, potential prime time matchup.
The other one with the 17 game schedule is kind of interesting because, that does give you the opportunity maybe to do some games abroad and to maybe do some sort of special neutral site games with that. Do you see, again, I don't know if the NFL would ever do that, but do you, any chance you think that they play around with like a YouTube or a Facebook and maybe go sell something as a one-off just to see the experiment on one of that extra inventory game?
Yeah, I have long believed that they're going to carve out some sort of package for one of the big digital companies, most likely Amazon. So like Amazon can come in with a $2 billion deal like ESPN pays for Monday Night Football, and it's going to be basically the London games, that start at 9:30, or it's not going to be a package that's really going to excite a fan base to go to Amazon. But I can easily see them carving off something for that.
Last one for me, John, and this is, we don't have to spend a lot of time on this, but if you had to guess today, do you think Joe Tessitore and Booger McFarland will be ABC's Monday Night Football crew next year?
I would put those chances at like 5%.
And now this is independent of Roma, who I think both of us are on the record probably 1,000 times saying we both believe he'll be back at CBS.
Although, can I tell you one thing about Romo, Richard? I was 100% Romo going back to ESPN. Why isn't it, or going back to CBS, why hasn't it happened yet? Like, the longer this goes on, I think I'm down to 95% he stays at CBS. I'm just confused at what I thought was going to be a relatively easy deal seems to be sort of, you know, dragging on.
Yeah, I will still hold and contend that Romo goes back to CBS. I would have thought it would have been done sooner. I think it will be done in the next couple of weeks. And the only thing I can tell you from embedding with that team is Romo has said it takes him like, you know, five years to make a decision to go out to dinner at the end of the week with his wife. That said, he knows everything he needs to know about CBS. The only question all about all this, of course, is just money. And like, you know, does money, what's the motivating factor with money? And is it enough to move into a new network, a new schedule, et cetera? But yeah, I think you ask a very fair question. We're approaching March and the deal is still not done. The only thing, John, about the Tessitore McFarland question is if you were going to ask me, I would put Tessitore coming back at like 50, 55%, and I would put McFarland much lower. This is just my read of it. I think the decision on the play-by-play announcer will be much different than the decision on the analyst, but we'll see. I say part of that is ESPN does not necessarily have a ready-made play-by-play person to sort of come in. They can certainly make the change. They can even make the change in-house. But do you know what I'm saying, John? There's not like a Mike Tirico. There's not some automatic layup like this is going to be our NFL play-by-play guy. And that's why I don't think that's why I wouldn't put that at 10% as you did.
Yeah, but the more important decision for me, and this is why what we just 10% versus 50% is all a folly. They have to hire in the truck first, and that's almost a more important decision. And those are the guys that have to get comfortable with the on air talent. So really, I don't think even anybody at ESPN knows right now what's going to happen moving forward until they get that spot filled, and then that could be a person that is especially close with Sean McDonough, wants to bring him back, or you know wants to get Chris Fowler out of the college booth and bring him back, or something like that. You just sort of don't know what those personal relationships might happen from somebody that you know, really more in my mind, a more important hire than the play-by-play or the analyst.
Agreed. Yeah. Executive producer at that place, it will be the most important hire.
Check out our new NBA show, Beyond the Arc, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network, where you can find me, John Gonzalez, NBA insider Bill Reiter, and Ashley Nicole Moss 5 days a week talking all things NBA. Whether you're looking for insightful discussions, upbeat commentary, breaking news, interviews, or coverage of all the biggest stories in the NBA, our new show is the place to be 5 days a week. Download and follow Beyond the Arc on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
All right, let's do the XFL really quick. Austin Karp, your colleague and one of the best in the business said when it comes to ratings and objective ratings, reported as we're taping this today, the XFL averaged 1.61 million viewers for the four games in week three across ABC, Fox, FS1, and ESPN. That is down 22% from week two, which had a couple games on ABC, one on Fox and FS1, and down 48% from week one. Now, John, me and you have sort of been in this for a long time, and I think this is one where me and you are absolutely in agreement, is you never make these judgments on these leagues until like week six, week seven, week eight. It can't be fooled into whatever the debut number is because people get excited. They want to see football. All the promotional assets of the ESPNs and the Fox are pushing it. What really matters is like, where are we at week six and week seven, which, you know, gives you a little better sense. I would say this, John. This is just my take. The numbers are still better, I would think, than expectations for the season. So if you're the XFL and you're their media partners, you got to feel good. At the same time, we're starting to see what we always see. We're starting to see double-digit drops. How do you look at this?
I think it's good news. I think that you can certainly spin it as bad news. What did you say that the drop was from week one? That's approaching like
48% from week one, down 22 from week two.
Yeah, I mean, that's 48% is a massive drop from numbers that weren't especially like knocked out of the park, so to speak. But you know, if you take a look at the numbers, there are two ways to look at this. One is expectation level, And nobody's expecting the XFL to be the NFL or to be, you know, college football. But the XFL right now, when it's on, it's beating its competition. It's beating golf. It's beating college basketball. I mean, these aren't like hugely rated things, but you know, I don't think anybody will say that golf is not a strong sport. I don't think anybody's looking at college basketball and wondering if it's going to survive to year two. So I think, like, for me, the numbers are again, you can spin that 48% down. That looks bad no matter how you look at it. But I happen to know the networks are, you know, they're not thrilled, but yeah, they're happy with it. It's pretty close to where they were expecting it to be, and it's a, you know, pretty good programming for a February weekend afternoon.
Yeah, I think that's a fair view of it. I think, you know, to compare it to what it's going against, I think is a totally legitimate look. And again, I would just tell people, like, let's talk week six. You have week seven. You get a real sense of what they are, and then you maybe start to think about, like, what kind of staying power might they have for year two. You know, the only sort of tough thing I think eventually for this league is it's going to be real hard for them to get publicity once when they're not playing in terms of a lead up to the following year. You know, they're not talked about on the sports shows and not talked about on sports talk radio, probably outside of very, very few markets. And that'd be another thing to look at too, what the local numbers are, and are the local numbers like sort of maintaining or are they dropping? But it's February, and you know, you can compete against these other programs in February. You're not going against the NFL.
Can I do a Richard Deitch podcast shout out since we're talking about the XFL?
Sure.
I was at game one in DC, the DC Defenders, a thrilling victory over the hated Seattle Dragons. And Bill Hoffheimer was on the field, and he brought his brother, who is a religious Richard Deitch podcast listener.
Really? Who? I did not know that.
His brother did not stay for the game, though. His brother took off to watch a Virginia basketball game, so it just sort of shows the level of commitment there. But I thought that's worthy of us shouting out there.
The one thing about Hoffheimer and his Twitter feed is it just feels too negative to me, John. Your thoughts?
The happiest man in Bristol. It's always sunny in Bristol. It's always sunny.
That is true. All right. Let us move to High Noon. And this was, we're taping this on Tuesday afternoon. This was your story that came out less than 24 hours ago, that High Noon is being canceled by ESPN in March. I want to get into this a little bit with you because it's sort of interesting how ESPN put this out there. And it's even more interesting than talking to the person who broke that story. I'll put broke in quotes, John. Don't take that personally. The explanation that ESPN had, John, was that this was a viewership issue. Okay. The viewership, and again, these are all your numbers, so great job on this. High Noon had averaged 330,000 viewers in quarter one to date, down 3% from the same period last year, and below the other ESPN debate shows. Most of those debate shows obviously happen after High Noon, and obviously your ratings would be up a little bit. So to me, John, that number, while it's not going to knock your socks off, that number is not crazy bad either, given the time slot. For me, my read, call it informed read, call it non-informed read, but my read on this, sort of having covered these guys for a long time and obviously knowing some of the people who are involved in this, is Bomani Jones and Pablo Torre have contracts coming up that expire in April. Certainly in Bomani Jones's case, signed a pretty big contract when he, the last time sort of he did this, for significant money. And I think this feels as much, John, as a move to sort of shred a little bit of talent salary, even if Pablo and Bomani end up staying, versus this show is absolutely not working because it's a ratings crater and we're getting rid of it. You probably have a different viewpoint than I do, but this feels much more like we're talking money that wants to be shred. We got an executive, Norby Williamson, who has no connection necessarily to these guys. These are John Skipper hires and John Skipper POVs, and same with Jimmy Pitaro, the new president, not the guy who sort of formed the show. The previous guy did. How do you read all this, John? Which I imagine might be a different read than mine.
Well, you know what's great is every time we wade into programming like this, we disagree. And I tend to take management side, and you tend to take the other side. I have to tell you, I think that's an incredibly smart take. I know that across, and that's a compliment, by the way, across sports media right now, I'm going to go back like 10 years, right? Like Fox Sports 1 launched, all of a sudden you had Nick Khan and CAA getting all the talent, and you saw these talent salaries rise dramatically across the board. And I think ESPN in particular, but also Fox and NBC to a lesser extent, have been systematically trying to get those salaries sort of back in whack. And so I think having something like High Noon and getting rid of those salaries and replacing them with like Jalen and Jacoby, you know, is something that makes a lot more fiscal sense. Absolutely, I agree with that. Those numbers aren't very the viewership numbers aren't very good. On my Twitter feed, a lot of people were comparing them to Get Up, and they compare very favorably to Get Up. And a lot of people are suggesting that it's not a good time slot to be in. Man, that afternoon time slot going into like Around the Horn and PTI and Highly Questionable, that's a good block of programming. And so, sort of the lead out of it is always much higher and much better than what High Noon was. So I don't dismiss at all that they weren't getting the viewers. I don't think they were getting the viewers too well. And just to close on one thing, just because I've covered media for such a long time, broadcast TV, they cancel shows, they change shows all the time, and it barely gets a blip. It's fascinating to me that ESPN tries to change, like, you know, outside the lines, and it there are so many. It just kind of speaks to the touch points that ESPN has with its audience, and because there's a lot of hue and cry over what is sort of in the media business a pretty basic move to make.
Okay, so that's interesting, and I appreciate your perspective on that. We do look at things differently, but that's an interesting and I think a smart take by you as well. So here's my sort of thought on what you just said. Part of the reason you're seeing the reaction, I mean, this, let's just not bullshit, this reality. Bomani Jones and Pablo Torre have a lot of friends in the business, or certainly admirers in the business, who are very active on Twitter with a ton of followers, who work for a lot of sports publications with very, very loyal audiences, you know, like The Ringer and places like that. I'm even talking about outside of ESPN.
Yeah, and I'll also jump in here and I'll speak for you. I find it hard to talk about them and that show because while I didn't watch that show a ton, it is a type of show that I think I would like. It's just a smarter, different look at sports instead of sort of people yelling at each other. So it is a show that personally I do kind of wish had succeeded, you know?
Yeah. And again, I'm the first to admit, I really barely watched the show. So I'm not going to sit here and tell you and sort of go chapter and verse and say, like, it's the greatest show I've ever seen of all time, because that's just not the case. Lord knows I worked with Pablo once at Sports Illustrated. I'm not going to praise that guy. I'm kidding. He seems like a nice guy. No, he is a nice guy. But yeah, so no, I'm realistic on this. This was not any kind of mega hit at all. I wouldn't even call it a hit. But it does speak to what you're saying, John, in that, like, you know, they did something that was a differentiator in the space, which was to try to at least elevate conversation. And I admire that very much. I think both guys are certainly bright and think outside the box, and I think that's a good thing too. They're probably a little dangerous for ESPN, which I think you'd even concede under Pitaro and Norby Williamson want to go more vanilla, because that's a very safer play and certainly safer with the NFL. But so here's the only thing, John, I don't even know if I'm calling it pushing back on you. It's a little bit of a pushback. You look at the numbers, and I agree with you, it's a good time slot, and particularly a good time slot because of what it leads into. But if you look at, John, over the years, historically, like on that early afternoon block, whether it's like NFL Live or The Jump or 1.0 TL Daily, that number that they have, 330,000 viewers, that's not an outlier, John. That's in the ballpark of whatever has, generally speaking, been part of that ESPN block. I have no doubt that there are shows that have probably done a little bit better and shows that have done worse, but it's not, I don't know how to say this, John. Like that show's not drawing 180,000. You know, this is not Undisputed numbers. And that, to me, if it was those kind of numbers, then I think if you're ESPN management, you walk out there and say, you know what, the ratings are tanking and we can't afford this. I think then that's a real argument. I just think the honest part of this, which we're not going to get out of Bristol, is we got high salaries for a show that is not part of the interruption, that is not bringing in 800,000, a million viewers. We have an opportunity, because the contracts are coming up, to shed that salary and either keep them at a much lower salary and at the same time probably replace it with sort of easier programming to do. And that's what I think this is ultimately about. Now, it's certainly a fair counter to me to say, hey, you know what? If these guys wanted to stay on, they would have pulled the 500,000 viewers and they would have made the decision impossible for ESPN. But that's just where I stand on it. I think, having sort of covered this terrain just like you have, I think this is as much about contractual issues as anything else.
So, Richard, what do you think happens? Do Bellamy and Pablo re-sign with ESPN?
It's a great question. So here's how I would look at this, and I have never been in this position where I have made the kind of money that they've made and would have to take a pay cut. So what I think will happen, and this is just a guess, is I think ESPN would like both to stay. They're both talented people. They're both people of color. They could be assets in other parts of ESPN for sure, in terms of being part of the other Eric Rydholm shows, writing for their website, pushing their ESPN Plus product, and, you know, John, whatever other sort of ESPN entity outside of live games that you want to use. The question is, how do those guys feel about what will be a salary offer that will be significantly less? And I don't know how, you know, that, and this is where I'll counter and go back to you on this. 4 years ago, 3 years ago, I think there would have been a market for them, either together or separate. You know, you talk to your agent reaches out to FS1 or some other place. FS1 loves to grab talent from ESPN, you know, and they offer you some kind of like, you know, radio/TV deal, and you're either making the same money or you're making more money. But that leverage doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, it's just not there. I mean, Jamie Horowitz leaving Fox was sort of a killer for that pipeline.
Right. So, you know, I think either you have to think about, you know, if you're them, you think about what else is out there. Now, they could be successful elsewhere. I mean, you know, Michael Smith and Jamel Hill and my buddy Jay McManus and others. You know, there's life after ESPN. That's unquestionably true. But how do you feel about whatever that life would be after ESPN? Because it's not probably going to be the same visibility. Without knowing anything, John, I'm going to guess minimum one stays. Perhaps both stay short term. But I don't know that. I haven't talked to them. I couldn't tell you that for sure.
And then what gets created for them? Because they went from helming a half-hour show to, you know, I think Bomani has a couple of podcasts now, sort of. Yeah, there's going to be more than that, but and there has to be, I would think, to sort of stick around.
I don't know if what gets created for them is them. I think what they may end up doing is doing things sort of separately. I don't know this, but it seems to me that it would be easier for Pablo to go back into the HQ, around the horn, fill in part of the interruption, write for the website kind of job. Like, I feel like that, I think he would go back to that, and I think he would do that. I don't know about Bomani. You know, Bomani was part of HQ already. Going back to that feels like a step back. I don't know. But, you know, at the same time, the reality for both these guys is, like, you know, so if these guys offer you like $600,000, $700,000 a year, like, where else are you getting that? You know, even if you got to sort of bite your ego and suck it up, that's still lottery ticket money. So I don't know. I think it's a great question. But I do think, and I wasn't surprised at this, but I certainly was, it was interesting to me that when you broke your item in your newsletter, it was fascinating to see the reaction from a lot of people to the cancellation of that show, and not necessarily that it was canceled, but like what they thought it represented in terms of cancellation. You know what I mean? That like smart kind of talk can't succeed in the sports debate universe. And that was kind of interesting to me, just that reaction.
Yeah, and in fact, I was fascinated. It was actually really fascinating to me. Like, if you know, on Twitter, you can look at your mentions and only see the verified accounts, and all the blue check marks all bemoaned it, and they all were just doing sort of elegies to it. And once you sort of took the blue check marks away and read all of the other ones, they were more sort of much more of them, a much higher percentage of them were sort of jumping on the grave and seemingly happy about it for some reason.
Yeah. Oh, well, I'm not sure it's a some reason. I think it's a pretty obvious one. You know, the one thing, John, I will say this, and I think both of us will appreciate this, and that is, do you realize that if High Noon was on Fox Sports 1, it would basically, like, they would have a parade for those two guys in Los Angeles, like, given how big a hit it would be?
Andrew McVarity would be asking me to write a story on that for, how come you're not writing about High Noon?
Yeah, it's so fascinating to me in that. I mean, listen, this is the difference between being part of a place that's been around for 40 years. But like literally, they wouldn't just be a hit at Fox Sports 1. Fox Sports 1 would put them out there as like one of their mega hits of the entire network, because they would have gotten viewership numbers that were akin to like ESPN debate shows. So it's so interesting to me, like, the world of expectations. You know what I mean, John? That like at ESPN, that, you know, there is a threshold, whether it's hubris or reality, that they expect to get. But you put High Noon on on Fox Sports 1 or NBC Sports Network in the afternoon, literally, like those guys would be feted like kings. It's just fascinating.
Yeah, with those numbers, yeah, incredible.
Yeah. All right, let's finish up on two things. One, the NBA and the local ratings. I think you, if it wasn't you, then it was somebody obviously you work with at Sports Business Daily or Journal, had all sorts of NBA RSN numbers. And, you know, they were not good. You know, locally, the NBA has been struggling. Now, my sense is, and we might see some upticks late in the year. I would think New Orleans is going to be up now that Zion's back. We get to the late part of the year, playoff races should raise those. But what were your sort of overall findings on the local? We know the national story, but what about the local story from the NBA?
Well, the local story and the national story are the same story. And what I find to be most interesting about this is, if you listen to Adam Silver talk about the ratings drop off, you can, and I have for like 20 years been writing about, oh, well, you know, injuries or teams that didn't do as well as they thought, or people moving out west and late game starts. Adam Silver barely brings that up, even though they're all applicable to the NBA. He brings up the fact that kids aren't connected to cable, and the NBA has tethered itself to ESPN and TNT. And you know, I think he called it I forget what the word was, a damaged business or something along those lines. Or he wants to do whatever he can to get those games in front of people like my son, who's 20 years old. And he points to various metrics on YouTube. He points to like Twitter, and you know, he believes, and I agree with him, that the NBA is completely popular among that group. They're just not watching television, and it's a really interesting way to look at this that suggests, like, you know, we really are, you know, with ESPN Plus and, you know, HBO Max and Peacock, we really are at the cusp of just a wild change in how we're going to be consuming all this stuff.
Yeah, all true. Although the interesting thing, like if at least in terms of the NBA story, is they could actually turn out to get a pretty fascinating postseason story. If somehow the Pelicans and the Lakers played in the opening round, you'd have maybe conference final level viewership for the opening round in the NBA. And then logically, if Toronto's not in the NBA Finals, John, and it's almost any American city, even Milwaukee, those numbers should go up just because you're going to get a secondary. You're going to get a you're going to get a market this year that you didn't get last year. So the NBA Finals could actually end up being up this year, just for the fact that you just might have a you know, an American team in the market. Although selfishly, I'd love to see Toronto go back, given where I live. But that's worth watching for sure. All right, last one, John, is and again, I think this is your story that you broke, and it is really one of the more fascinating ones. The SEC. With the help of its, you know, with the help of its CAA X-Wing fighters, is going to move to ESPN, you know, move the football package to ESPN starting in 2023. And what remains fascinating is, will CBS, like, be a lame duck for the next couple of years? Will they keep this programming? Or, as you have theorized, will ESPN and CBS cut some kind of deal to get the SEC football programming, top football game on ESPN prior to the end of that contract? What looks like, John, now, at least at the moment, is it, unless you know something different, it looks like CBS is going to have it for this year. But that is just, that whole thing is fascinating to me. One, it's probably the, you know, the best bargain, or if not the best bargain, one of the best bargains in the history of television in terms of rights. And then secondly, it's interesting for CBS. They got a tough decision, because you can make some cash on this deal until it leaves you. Or do you trade some kind of, you get some kind of assets from ESPN in exchange for what's an amazing deal? Really fascinating, actually, in terms of, like, sort of a sports business media story.
So I think it was about a month ago, I was on another sports media podcast, Richard. I forget which one it was. And I said it was not, I was 95% sure, I put it, that ESPN was going to be able to buy out the remaining years from CBS. The second that podcast went live, I got two calls from people who would know, who were like, "You're dead wrong." CBS right now pays $55 million a year for the SEC, which is nothing. It is the sweetheart of sweetheart deals. Lord knows what ESPN would have to bid, or would have to pay, to sort of take that away from CBS, and then possibly give programming on top of that. I'm not saying it's not going to happen. It has happened in the past with other sports on for lame duck years, but this deal is so good, and CBS is, you know, just peeved enough at how this process went that they're not looking to dole out any favors on this thing.
John, if I was David Burson, Sean McManus, and that group, I would not deal. I would keep the package until the end of the package, and then give it to ESPN when it's up. I think, to me, you, given the cost that you are paying for the SEC, it is such an incredible deal that I think to give up that money and that potential revenue for 2 years, whatever ESPN might give me asset-wise, would not be worth it. I also kind of like the fact that you're sticking it to both the SEC and ESPN, too, if you keep it for a couple of years. I like that aspect of it, too. But I just wouldn't give it up. It's just, the programming is too great.
What if ESPN, like, guarantees them, like, a third pick of an SEC game through, like, 2030? So it will be a damaged package, but you get it for, like, an extra decade, you know, or something. But I'm told that it would have to be a lot better than that, because they're going from the top game, and who's to say too? Think about when they, if they run out the string on, if CBS runs out the string on the SEC, and then all of a sudden the Big Ten comes up, you know, and boy, they can bid hard on that to fill that window, or the you know, Pac-12. Could come up, and they could. The brands aren't quite as good as The brands aren't as good as the SEC, but you know, the CBS is looking to fill college football programming right there, and they have proven, as they have with the SEC, that they can help build up a league. I think
that's a great point. I will say this: the people who, I think this is an Anthony, this is from Anthony Krupe, our buddy from Ad Age, who does an amazing job, and you should read his stuff on this. But the notion somehow that CBS is going to back away from the NFL, given the amount of money that they're saving in some places, is just absurd. You know, it sucks to lose the SEC for sure, but you just take that $300 million and you head towards Roger Goodell and company. So I don't see, I mean, they've lost it before, but man, I would be stunned if CBS lost the NFL. I just don't see it.
The idea that any one of these broadcast networks will lose the NFL is inconceivable to me. I mean, it's just not going to happen.
Basically, it's holding up the entire broadcast outfit. It seems you don't have a business without it anymore.
You would have to go out of business. CBS could possibly go out of business if they lose the NFL, in my opinion. So, yeah.
Correct. Yeah. Which is why I'm with you, which is why it's, in my opinion, it's not going to happen. It also benefits the NFL.
I also don't believe that. I was speaking in a hyperbole there to make a point. They're not going out of business, but
yeah. No.
All right, Jen Sabatel, you don't have to call me. I was a hyperbole, okay?
I'm not sure. Yeah. The odds of Jen Sabatel listening to this podcast, I would say, are about 30%.
Her assistant will.
it's a little lower than Tessa Torre returning. All right. John Orand is the fine Sports Business Daily media writer, Sports Business Journal media writer. Had some major stories this week of significant note, especially among the Twitter crowd. Check out his work. Check out his newsletter. I say this all the time whenever he's on. It's the newsletters that Sports Business Daily are doing are awesome. They're just so much fun to read, and they break stories in it. I mean, man, a newsletter that breaks news is just phenomenal.
Yeah, we have Ben Fisher doing the NFL on Fridays, Michael Smith doing college on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Yeah, we're building a nice little group of newsletters there.
Yeah, I agree. Michael and Ben do an awesome job on that. I love reading those two guys as well. So if you're a Sports Business Daily subscriber, check those newsletters out. It is free with your subscription. All right, John, listen, I appreciate you coming on. You gave me 40-something minutes. And continued success. I will, if I don't see in person, I'll be hearing you on another on a competing podcast. So that'll be exciting for me. Thank you, John. John Orand, everybody.
Team Deitch. Team Deitch till I die.
All right, back in the studio. My thanks to John Orand. That was a really good conversation, actually. The high noon stuff, I hope you found interesting. I certainly did. And I appreciate him coming on today. Previous guests on this podcast include Tiffany Green and Megan McPeak. They are pioneering broadcasters in that women of color who are doing play-by-play, essentially sort of creating and forging their own path. I love talking to those two guys. And that's the previous one before John. Before that, Jamie Little and Shannon Speak of Fox and NASCAR. And they sort of take you through how the Daytona 500 gets covered from their end and their own careers. Before that, covering Kobe Bryant and his career, Howard Beck. A Bleacher Report, Tim Kawakami, my colleague at The Athletic. And then before that, the producer and director of the Super Bowl, how Super Bowl gets produced and directed, Richie Zients and Rich Russo. Go through the all the archives in the Sports Media with Richard Deitch podcast. And if you like these conversations, please leave us a review. 5-star review would help, and write up something nice. That's how the podcast remains. As always, let me thank everybody. Caves 13 wasn't too long ago that I stopped in the New York offices. Looked beautiful. Thank you to Chris Corcoran, Spencer Brown, Sean Cherry, John McDermott, and obviously, of course, my producer, Patrick Antonetti. We'll be back next week with another edition of the Sports Media with Richard Deitch podcast. Until then, thanks so much for listening.